just waiting for this recording status to do its thing. Looks like we're right to go. Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to the call. This is Pinky McKay here, and our topic for today is physical interaction and social engagement, essential ingredients for learning. With me today is Sally Goddard-Blythe. Sally is a consultant in neurodevelopmental education and the director of the Institute for Neurophysiological Psychology, which is INPP for short, in Chester in England. Sally is also the author of several books and published papers on child development and neurodevelopmental factors in specific learning difficulties, including Reflexes, Learning and Behaviour, The Well-Balanced Child, and What Babies Really Need. Her newest book, Attention, Balance and Coordination, The ABC of Learning Success, was published by Wiley Blackwell in April this year, so that's her latest book. Sally is also the author of the INPP Test Battery and Developmental Exercise Program for use in schools to help teachers identify physical readiness for learning, and a program of exercises designed to encourage physical readiness in children who have problems. Sally has lectured on the role of infant reflexes in development and later learning problems to many different groups throughout Europe and in different parts of the United States. She's a member of the International Alliance for Childhood and the Open Eye Campaign, a pressure group dedicated to ensuring that children's developmental needs remain at the top of the agenda for government recommendations for early years education in England. In our call today, Sally will be explaining how, despite all the inventions and wonders of the modern technological age, human beings are designed to grow up in the physical world, receiving sensory stimulation, movement opportunity, and engagement with the primary source of love in the early years. Hi, Sally, and welcome.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure, Sally, and we've got people who are really wanting to know this information. Sally, can you give us a little background about your work in the area of early learning and the Institute for Neurophysiological Psychology, and how did you become involved in this work?
Oh, gosh, partly by accident. And also as a result of a long, and in my case, possibly very delayed process of development, I think. My first area of study at university many years ago was in history and fine arts, so a very remote connection to what I do now. Except that at the end of the first year in fine arts, we spent several weeks studying the artist's unique view of the world and how visual perception affects not only how we experience the world, but also how we express ourselves in it. And that combined with the fact that I think I grew up in a household where classical music was always present, because my father was a classical musician. And music was always as much a part of language as the speech itself, from as long as I can remember. Then, a few years later, of my three children, the eldest had sleeping problems for the first 18 months of life. The second was diagnosed with a hearing impairment when he was 16 months old. And it was really my search to find a solution to their problems with the background of the sort of arts and music before it that I fell into the work that I do now. And it was only some years later that I then went on to do a bachelor's and a master's in psychology. So a whole sort of mixture of things really combined to bring me to where I am now.
Wow, yeah, it is. And nothing is, I was just talking with my daughter-in-law who's doing teaching at the moment, that, you know, nothing in your prior life is wasted, is it? It all comes together and forms this lovely background of, you know, how everything works for people.
Yes, and one's never really aware at the time.
No, you're not doing it with an end in mind that, you know, this will help my children or I will understand my children better or anything like that. This all comes together. Okay, so what do you do at the Institute of Neurophysiological Psychology? Do you want to explain just a little bit more of that?
We are a sort of mixture of a clinical centre trying to help children with problems, research based on the work that we do with children, and a training centre as well in actually teaching other professionals how to do or how to use some of the techniques that we've developed here. So it was set up with the idea of investigating whether there were underlying physical factors in children who were presenting with symptoms of specific learning difficulties, so reading problems, writing problems, underachievement, and emotional problems. So the first part was to see were physical factors actually playing a part. And then the second thing was to see, having identified that they was there anything that we could do to try and put some of those physical problems right? And that took us right back to looking at early child development and asking the question, could we go back in time and give an older child a second chance to replicate some of the movements and the stages that it should have made in the first years of life to make up the gaps that seem to be present in that child's functioning and in that child's system? So that's pretty much what we do.
Okay, and you have found that you can take the children back and make a difference?
You can, indeed, yes.
Okay, so we'll talk a bit about that. It's so much easier, though, if the child goes through these natural, this natural process of maturation, doesn't it?
Well, if they get it right the first time round, it saves another year, a few years later, having to put it right.
That's right, yeah. And you say, Sally, that the process of maturation and development is hardwired into the brain before birth, and that environmental opportunity and experience are like the software which enables the hard drive to not only reveal its potential, but which, more importantly, in living creatures, also changes the architecture of the developing brain and nervous system. Can you explain this innate sequence of development for our listeners, please?
I think this is going to be quite a long story, so I hope you're all sitting comfortably. From the very earliest beginnings, movement is the outward expression of life. So from when the embryo's heart first starts to beat to the feats of the greatest athletes, movement has always been there in the background. And movement begins during life in the womb and is one of the first ways in which the developing baby responds to its external environment. I say that movement is, in many senses, our very first language. By the time of birth, certain movement reactions are hardwired into the developing brain, so that given a particular stimulus or a particular type of trigger, the healthy baby will make a predictable and, in many cases, stereotyped response. Now, some of these responses are actually called primitive reflexes, and anyone who's had regular contact with a young baby will recognize some of them. So let me give you a few examples. If you place a finger into the palm of a newborn baby's hand, the thumb and the fingers will grasp it. And as adults, we're terribly egotistical, and we tend to say, oh, isn't it sweet? Baby loves me, doesn't want to let me go. Poor little thing actually has no choice at this moment. This is a reflex action that is hardwired into the system. Another one is, if you were to gently stroke down one side of the baby's mouth, the head would then turn to the same side as you had stroked, and the mouth will open as the baby roots or searches, looking for the breast or the bottle. In this way, it's the sense of touch, initially, which gradually leads the infant a few weeks later into visual recognition of the source of nourishment, so that the sight of the breast or bottle alone will be enough to set off sucking movements. So although the reflex itself is there as an innate reaction, it's the usage of the reflex that's important in leading into other skills. And these early reflexes have only a very short active lifespan in normal development. Somewhere around 6 months of postnatal life, they're gradually suppressed or put to sleep by higher connections in the brain, as connections from lower centers in the brain to higher ones develop and strengthen. At the same time as these connections are made, they're gradually replaced by a second group of reflexes, which are called postural reflexes. And as these develop in the first 3.5 years of life, they enable the baby to gain good automatic or unconscious control of posture and balance in a gravity-based environment. And that unconscious control provides a stable foundation for coordination, freeing up higher centers in the brain so that they can concentrate on things other than simply body control. Our higher thinking part of the brain should be available to process the external environment, to analyze, to think not logically. But if it's over-involved in still controlling basic functions of the body, such as balance and posture, it gets overworked and it starts to affect higher aspects of learning and behavior and so on. So I don't know whether that explains what you wanted me to answer.
It does, yeah. And you know, this process that's hardwired into the baby, we all talk about, you know, the throwaway line, you have to crawl before you can walk and those sorts of things. How are these reflexes inhibited, and why are they important perhaps for later learning?
They're inhibited by the sort of dual process of maturation and development. So as the baby grows, so some of the changes in those reflexes should take place as a part of the baby just maturing and the nervous system maturing. But they are also partly environmentally dependent. That maturation doesn't take place on its own. It takes place in the context of interaction with the physical environment. So that means the type of movement opportunities the baby has, the sensory opportunities, how much interaction it has with its mother, with its father, with its other primary caregivers. So we need to have plenty of physical opportunity in the first year or years of life to enable that innate process of maturation to take place completely.
Okay, so what are some of the essential ingredients of this nurture during the early years?
Well, primarily physical contact.
But can you be
just a little bit
more specific about what people can actually do with their babies, perhaps?
Well, I'd say the first thing is physical contact with the primary source of love, which ideally is the mother. I mean, it can be other people, but ideally, if she's available, it should be the mother. Combined with continuity of care, stability, and also the setting of secure boundaries. So that sounds like quite a lot of things, but actually it's not as complicated as it might sound. And possibly the best example is to go back and look at some less technologically advanced societies where babies are in almost constant physical contact with their mothers in the first year of life, either carried on their mother's back as she works or perhaps carried in a sling. And babies who are carried in a sling have instant access to the breast whenever they want, and they learn quite quickly how to comfort themselves when they want to feed or suckle. They just reach for the breast and they start feeding. And this is, in a sense, an early form of self-regulation, or the ability to regulate their own emotional state whenever they need comfort or are hungry, a very important skill to learn because we're going to need it for the rest of our lives. And these children who are in continuous contact with their mother tend to cry less and fret less than children in more complex societies. And in some of these cultures, mothers are so attuned to their baby's physical needs that when the baby needs to urinate or defecate, the mother simply lifts it off her body, places him or her over the ground, and then when they've finished, picks them up again, which is something which I think most of us living in more technologically advanced societies just can't imagine being able to do for, without diapers, nappies, whatever else you want to call them. Now, I realize that what's possible in one culture isn't necessarily suitable or applicable for another. So in the UK, for example, climate would be just one factor that would make that last example absolutely impossible. But there is also a great deal that we could learn from these examples. And what they tend to do is to pose the question, why? What does the baby gain from physical contact? What are the ingredients of physical contact that are so important? Well, the first one is obviously touch, continuous touch, which helps to develop a baby's sense of body map, where he or she actually physically is in space. The familiar sense of smell, which is comforting, and also, as I've talked about, the instant access to the breast whenever it wants it. But perhaps one of the hidden factors is the continuous stimulation that's provided to the balance mechanism when a baby is carried. And the balance mechanism is the sensory system which responds to movement. It's our expert, if you like, in movement control. And mothers the world over instinctively know that rocking helps to calm a fussy infant, so that when a baby's crying, we'll pick it up and we will naturally tend to rock or swing from side to side. Now, this movement actually simulates the gentle rhythm of being carried when someone is walking. The movements that the baby has known inside its mother's womb before birth, and which continue to provide it with comfort and security after birth, as well as helping to train its own balance mechanism for later, more advanced skills. And various studies that have been done using increased stimulation to the balance mechanism, such as placing a baby on the mother's lap and gently spinning it for several minutes a day, have shown that children who have more stimulation to the balance mechanism in the early years show more advanced motor development than babies who actually don't have very much movement opportunity. And then finally, physical contact also helps mother to attune to the baby's needs or to each other's needs without the need necessarily for verbal language. And this body language is the basis of nonverbal communication, which accounts for up to 90% of effective communication between individuals later on. and actually provides the basis for what we later understand as being sympathy or empathy, the ability to feel as another and to respond appropriately, which is so important for all aspects, not just of a child's social development, but of how societies interact with each other generally.
That's brilliant. I'm just enjoying listening to this. We have so many people, and it's as though infant sleep is the new milestone, and people are saying, don't rock the baby. I was interested to read a book by Sharon Hillier. I don't know if you've read it. She's a psychologist from the UK, from the United States, sorry. And she talks about, it's called The Vital Touch. And she talks about how some women now, more women are having more sedentary pregnancies. So some of our babies might actually be craving more movement afterwards. So they might be expressing this need to be rocked and held a little bit more than perhaps a baby who's been inside a more active mother, to stimulate their balance system.
I think that's certainly a possibility. And we know from our own clinical experience that where there have been difficult pregnancies, where the mother has needed a lot of bed rest during the latter part of the pregnancy, that those children seem to have underdeveloped posture, balance and coordination later on, so that a large amount of bed rest, see, and presumably therefore a lack of stimulation before birth, does seem to affect the baby's development after birth.
Oh, interesting that you can affirm that. Yeah. So these, what would these parents do perhaps? What would they need to do? Do more movement exercises with their baby, more, give them more carrying, more rocking?
I think before birth, provided the pregnancy is healthy, I think to live an active and healthy life with plenty of gentle physical exercise is a good thing. After birth, I think it's going back to a lot of the old-fashioned things we used to have in our nurseries. And I don't wish to contradict this American writer's work, but I think the old idea of the swinging cradle, which gives vestibular stimulation from side to side, a rocking chair for the mother to sit in when she's feeding her baby, which gives forwards and backwards stimulation to the balance mechanism. Carrying your baby if and when you can, and lots of gentle rough and tumble play that is appropriate to the baby's particular age. Babies tend to love it. You know, they squeal with laughter and joy when they're thrown from, well, not literally thrown, but gently.
And bounce up and down on people's knees and on the foot with the leg crossed. They love all that, don't they?
Yes, yes, absolutely love
the it. Ride type stuff, yeah.
Yes.
So often it's looking to the baby, isn't it, and what they're enjoying and what they're craving and what they're signalling they need.
You know, and babies are different. There are some who don't like to be too much rough and tumble play, and you have to be sensitive to individual babies' needs and
that's
temperament.
That's right. You can't just do things.
You just can't assume that
what's
right. Make
you big and strong and clever.
What's right in theory is right for all. It isn't.
No. So how do, the early movement and sensory experiences develop the brain pathways for the later formal learning, such as reading and writing? And perhaps what some of these sensory experiences could be?
Many of the movements naturally made by the infant in the first year of life are in themselves rudimentary training movements for later skills. So even the reflexes themselves actually have a training function. So earlier I gave the example of the rooting reflex, starting off as a touch response and then gradually leading into visual recognition of the breast or the bottle. And babies will spend many happy hours watching their hands move, come and go from in front of their faces without realizing that these toys are actually attached to themselves. Similarly, reaching for their feet and putting their toes in their mouths, something which I can still only do metaphorically these days. And all of these early movement experiences help to train, first of all, the visual system to focus at different distances, but also, more importantly, for the baby's brain to know where their own body parts are and where the body begins and ends. And later on, this will actually develop layer on layer. So, for example, crawling helps to train hand-eye coordination at the same visual distance that the child will use when having to read and write some years later, as well as helping the eyes learn how to track or cross the midline from left to right and from right back to left again, which we're going to need when we read. We have to be able to follow a line of print starting on the left-hand side of the page and then we have to make a big regressive eye movement back to the beginning of the line on the other side of the page to start again. And these very basic eye movement skills are partially trained through the early stages of motor development, provided the child has had plenty of opportunity to go through each one of those stages. And there is also...
Go on. Keep going. No, I'm waiting for you. I didn't know when you were taking your breath. Funny little delay we've got.
There is also a link between hand and foot movements and development of speech. One of the things you find when you start to work in this field is that you start to observe babies in all sorts of peculiar situations. So often when I'm on holiday and I have longer to notice things, I'll say to my husband, just watch that baby over there. And the first 18 months of life, babies will vigorously flex and extend their toes and kick their legs just before they start to vocalize. So even if it's only cooing or babbling, just before they start to vocalize, you will see the motor movements taking place first. Rather as if they're exercising important pathways throughout the body in preparation for speech. And it's important to remember that the first language is one of gesture. We understand our baby's needs through their body language long before they tell us what they want, or they're able to tell us what they want with words. And similarly, pathways involved in the development of independent finger movements also seem to be linked to speech. So, for example, when I assess older children and we ask them to do a simple thumb and finger opposition test where they have to tap each finger with the thumb 5 times, those children who have difficulty with finger dexterity are nearly always, without exception, the children who have a history of delayed speech or have needed speech and language therapy in the past. That there is a definite link between the motor centers involved in fine finger movements and the mouth movements necessary for speech and language. So these very early movement capabilities are like the building blocks for later, more complex skills, of which language is just one. I have finished now.
Okay. I'm getting totally engrossed in trying to tap my fingers. Yeah, it's all right, my fingers work. And you said you talk a lot. So we mentioned the crawling and the, I guess, giving babies just that space to play and explore their bodies with, you know, and we often don't do that. We're in an age where there is a lot of baby equipment, aren't we? That, you know, people are encouraged to buy all sorts of gear for babies and educational and inverted commas gadgets for little ones. And we also live in a very high-tech environment too. So maybe, you know, babies plonked in front of television because it's educational, or we have educational DVDs, don't we? But perhaps first of all about some of that baby equipment and the effects of some of those things and what parents need to be wary of.
Well, first of all, I think I'd like to qualify what I'm going to say by pointing out that, as with most things, used in moderation or as an occasional tool to help a busy mother, baby equipment can be a bonus, and nearly all of us have used it. So, you know, it's wrong also to say, well, you must never use baby equipment and TV, because we live in a real world where, you know, all of us at times need a rest, and a little bit of things is not necessarily a bad thing. However, if one's going to look at the sort of what I call overuse of it, I would say try to avoid putting babies into confined spaces for long periods at a time and for every day. So, for example, baby seats are fine when your child's in the car or for carrying your baby from place to place for a short period of time, but they shouldn't become what I call the geriatric chair of infancy, where your baby spends most of his waking moments simply because it's more convenient. If we don't want our babies to become couch potatoes in the future, we shouldn't really start them off as couch potatoes in their first year of life. And the movement experience that a baby gets in the confines of a molded seat are completely different from having free movement opportunity when lying on the floor or when even being carried by a parent, certainly in terms of things like developing head control, the development of neck muscles, upper trunk control, and so on. And those very basic things, head control and trunk control, are the basis for having good control of posture, sitting, standing, the ability to sit and stand still later on, and they support coordination as well. So they sound like such small things, but they actually underpin really everything we're going to do for the remainder of our lives. And secondly, don't be tempted to use equipment to enable your baby to stand or walk before he's physically ready to do it by himself. This can unwittingly prevent him or her from learning to crawl and creep, simply because it's easier to be placed in that position and they're happier in the standing position without having to learn how to get into it by themselves. So, you know, it's like all things. A little and often is a little is fine, but don't use it as a surrogate babysitter or as a surrogate mother.
That's great. So you're talking about the ability to sit still and to stand still later on and how, you know, little ones need to do this movement. Can we go into that just a little bit more? Because obviously children do have to sit still some of the time when they get a bit bigger, don't they? And so you're saying some of these fidgety kids actually have a problem. They're not just being naughty, in inverted commas.
No. I mean, one of the things I say in giving lectures to teachers, if you have a child who can't sit still and pay attention for more than 20 minutes, you would get more out of that child if you allowed it to get up and run around for 2 or 3 minutes after 20 minutes and then sit down again. Because the most advanced level of movement is actually the ability to stay totally still. I mean, do you remember when you first learnt to ride a bike? Can you remember that? Can you?
No, I can't actually. That's a long time ago.
That's a long time ago. Well, some of us remember that.
I remember somebody holding the seat for hours and hours.
Well, yes, because once you get moving, actually it's speed of movement that helps you to maintain your balance. It's momentum that keeps you going. And the wobble sets in either when you are trying to get started or when you're slowing down to stop. So control of slow movement is actually much, or static balance, is much harder than when we are moving at speed. And children who have poor control of static balance are the ones who find it difficult to sit still and need continuous movement stimulation in order to maintain control of their bodies. So what you're seeing is like a paradox. A child who can't sit still doesn't need to be told to sit still. They actually need more movement opportunity and movement training in order to be able to stay still for longer periods.
Right. So that fits in with the small child who needs to move lots.
Yes. Allowing them to do it to begin with so that they have got control of the body and then they can sit still and pay attention to other things.
Right. Now, that's really good for parents too. Because often parents go a little bit spare, don't they, as soon as children become toddlers and they're climbing up everything and parents are just, you know, going spare because they've got to climb. I actually said to somebody the other day with a toddler that climbing is so good for children. It is so important for children. And, you know, so maybe even talk about some of those things that toddlers do and how,
as long as it's in a, you know, a safe, controlled environment where someone is available to make sure they're not going to fall and hurt themselves badly. Yes, I mean, climbing activities are great, and it's why things like the Jimbaroo program in Australia is so wonderful, because it's giving babies and their mums a chance to go and try all sorts of bits of equipment and to play together in a situation which is safe and controlled. And we need to ensure that that's also available in the home, and it's available in childcare centres if babies are actually being left in childcare centres because the mums had to go back to work.
The fact that they are given those opportunities to do the movement and to crawl and walk and run in free space and safe space. Okay, another thing that I'm noticing parents often do is they sit their babies before they can crawl. You got any thoughts on this one?
Yes.
Any advice on this one?
What I usually say is that the best, if I go back a step and say in the first year of life, the best playgrounds are free. They cost nothing. And the best playground of all after the mother's body in the first few weeks of life is actually the floor, placing your baby to play on the floor, tummy time when it's awake, tummy and back time. Now, sitting them on the floor is probably not such a bad thing as sitting them in a molded seat all day, because on the floor they will tend to topple, they'll go back onto, they'll fall onto their hands, they'll go back onto the tummy, and they get many different types of movement experience. sitting them in a little baby seat. They get lots of foot play. They may have a mobile in front of them to reach towards things, but they don't get the same contact in the tummy area, which helps to tell them where their tummy, where the trunk of the body is in space. They don't get the same opportunities, again, for developing head control and for learning how to sit themselves. Actually, it's quite a complex series of movements to get from lying to the sitting position and to maintain balance in a sitting position. If you're simply plonked there, it's not the same process at all as learning how to get there by yourself.
That's right, yes. Often I've seen babies, you know, my own children, I didn't actually sit them, and I noticed they get from crawling, you know, they start to wriggle and crawl and they'll get up on one side and they're sitting up and they've still got the idea that, yes, we do need to put a hand out if we're about to topple.
Exactly.
They seem to have a better sense of where they are.
Yes, yes. And that, what you're talking about there is what's called a parachute reflex, that when the baby puts its hand out as it topples, it's actually a protection reflex which comes in as it starts to learn more advanced types of balance, such as sitting and standing. And if you're plonked there before you're ready and you don't have that propping reflex or parachute reflex developed, the first time you fall over, it's very frightening because you haven't put out a hand to save yourself. So being put in that position before you're ready can actually have disadvantages as well as advantages.
Okay, so it's better to watch the baby and follow the baby as the baby's ready.
Yes, allow your baby every opportunity to develop the next stage and help it along the way, but not make it too easy for it to do it without it having to work itself.
That's good advice, isn't it? Yeah. When we're talking about television again, you know, realistically, many mums are quite isolated and they, as you said, have to get a few things done, so they do tend to use TV sometimes. Some people are very sparing with it. Others have it almost on as background noise. And so along that spectrum of TV use, have you got anything specific about how much would be too much for small children?
Well, let's start off with what you mentioned about background noise first, because I think we live in a very noisy modern world where background noise is there most of the time. And what many young parents don't realize is that the first 3.5 years of life are vital years for a baby to tune in to the sounds of its mother tongue. That when it's first born, it's like a little professor in waiting. It has the ability to learn any language under the sun if it's exposed to the sound of those languages regularly on a daily basis. So that there is this sort of window of opportunity of being able to hear a vast range of sounds covering many languages. But in that first 3.5 years, the baby tunes in to the sounds of its mother tongue. So it starts to lose the ability to hear sounds that aren't particularly relevant to its own language, but to tune in more precisely to the specific sounds that it will need, not only for talking, but for reading and for spelling and for writing later on. And if there is continuous background noise, it can interfere with the baby's ability to pick up those fine-tuning differences. So I don't know whether over this long distance from the UK to Australia you can actually hear this, but the difference between similar but different sounds, things like sa, fa, sa, sh, ch, m, n, p, b, many of the sounds that children later on have difficulty spelling, and when you do a really thorough audiometric assessment, you find that they have what we call auditory discrimination problems later on. They're not deaf, but they've never learnt to hear those vital fine-tuning differences between specific speech sounds, which are so necessary for all later learning skills. So background noise is a factor of its own, whether we're talking about the radio, whether we're talking about computer noise, always having music on. You need to be aware that sometimes silence, or not total silence, because we never have that unless we're in a soundproof booth, but to have background noise on all the time isn't necessarily in your baby's best interest. Secondly, if we start to look at the... Sorry, did you...
No.
If we start to look at TV and video games and those sort of things, they tend to provide a surfeit of visual and fine motor stimulation, but few of them integrate this with the development of gross muscle coordination and balance skills. And in actual fact, fine motor skills should be built upon gross motor skills. They shouldn't be developed as a completely separate entity. Otherwise, they're almost like a splinter skill rather than a part of integrated functioning. And although many of these electronic games are said to be interactive, in fact, the interaction is with an inanimate object in which the responses to the child have been pre-programmed and also pre-programmed by a person with a particular type of mindset. You know, it's a certain type of individual who creates computer programs. They're not necessarily representative of how other people would respond. And therefore, these pre-programmed electronic games are not adaptive to the immediate needs of the child. Neither do they help the child learn to read the body language of real people, the basis for up to 90% of effective communication later on. Many of them are also produced in short bites of time, requiring only a few seconds of attention at a time before moving on to something else. And this is quite different from the sustained attention that we need when we need to follow a conversation, when we're taking instructions, or reading the storyline of a book, that in some ways it encourages a degree of attention deficit disorder from a very, very early age. And Dr. Amen, and his, oh, I don't know whether he's Amen or Amen, he pronounces himself, but in his book, Healing ADD, he talks about the addictive properties of electronic games and how younger children are particularly susceptible to this, partly because the brainwave functioning of the younger child is different from how the adult brain functions. And it's more susceptible to alteration in brainwave functioning as a direct result of this type of stimulation. And he says this can encourage them to become fixed on electronic games to the detriment of real social relationships. And Eric Sigman, who I don't know whether he's come to Australia as well, but he describes them as being like a plug-in drug. Sorry?
What was that name again?
Dr. Eric Sigman. He's written a book called The Plug-in Drug, looking at the effects of TV and the media on the child's developing brain. And then the last possible effect is that the fantasy world of the electronic game, where the hero survives against impossible odds, is not the same as the real world. And the hero who can be resurrected time and time again by the touch of a button is not the same as the individual who is hit and hurt in the real world and who will never recover. And although children can separate fantasy from reality, if too much of their time is spent in that fantasy world, they could then potentially have difficulty in understanding the real effect of their behavior on others once they're in the playground and so on. So there are, you know, there are many different factors woven into that. And sort of realistically, to come back to your question after a very long answer as to how much is too much, I think probably it's best summarized in general terms by the American Academy of Pediatrics, which recommends that older children don't spend more than 1 to 2 hours a day either watching TV or engaged in video games. And they also recommend that children under the age of 2 shouldn't watch any at all, which actually is quite, you know, a difficult thing, I think, for young parents to do. They also add the proviso that programs should be nonviolent and educational. And most of all, they recommend that TV should not be a substitute for either playing, exercising, or reading. So I think the best advice is a small amount a day is probably not going to do anyone any harm. But the longer a child is engaged in those activities on a daily basis, the greater the possible risk of some of those things I've talked about actually starting to develop.
And that's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, it really is when we look at all of the possible effects. And the video games are being made now for younger and younger children, aren't they?
They are, yes.
They're, you know, toddlers upwards. And people are presenting a lot of things as educational when actually they may not be helping at all. And there was research about some of those educational DVDs, wasn't it? They did some studies on babies who'd watched, I won't mention the brand, but they were saying that they actually weren't as well-developed as babies who hadn't seen them at all.
Well,
but I guess
like,
that, again, like you say, it's about how much and what other experiences those babies are having.
And there is some research, I can't remember the sort of reference for it off the top of my head, but which looks at how in early development, if you continuously overstimulate one area, you will develop that area, but sometimes at the risk of underdevelopment elsewhere, that the brain scavenges energy and pathways to develop one area to the detriment of others. And really, it's what we want in our children and in society later on is well-rounded children who have a range of gifts and skills, of which the social skills are so important to how in the way they're going to treat other people and how they're going to view themselves in later life.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about the social development, Sally? I mean, I know that in reference to television, but perhaps you might like to talk a little bit more about that and how children develop.
Well, I think conversation is incredibly important. And conversation from a very, very early age. Colwyn Trevathan, who is Professor Emeritus at the University of Edinburgh, has overseen some wonderful research looking at the links between language, music, and interaction in the first year of life. And he, in his lecture, showed some film footage of a mother talking to her baby, showing that when she used motherese, that special sing-song language that mothers instinctively tend to use with their babies, not only her language, but the baby's answering phrases contain all the elements of music: melody, rhythm, phrasing, and cadence. But if the adult carries on talking without waiting for the baby to reply to each phrase that she's uttered, the baby actually gives up and appears to switch off, starts to look bored, and actually looks at the adult as if to say, "How rude you are. Don't you realize that this is a conversation in which I am also supposed to be involved?" So even at this very early age, polite conversation is a two-way process. And so the mother is simply going, "Oh, darling, blah, 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 blah." But she needs to wait for about 2 to 3 seconds. And if she waits, the baby will go, "da, da, 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 da," in an answering phrase. But if she hurries on and doesn't wait, the baby gives up trying to talk back. So from the very, very beginning, conversation is important. But parents need to remember that it is a two-way process, even before the baby can talk, and to be as interested in what the baby has to say back as what they are trying to say to him or to her. And once again, I think it's one of the problems with the electronic media. When it's used for too longer periods, the TV doesn't do that. It tells the baby lots of things. It keeps the baby quiet, it keeps it amused, but it doesn't listen to what the baby has to say back. And that's an essential ingredient of learning how to interact with others later on.
That's right. Yeah, so that's not just a breath, is it? Sorry, it's so funny with this bit of time delay. So,
yes,
you know,
it is,
you wait and then the other person's actually going to keep talking. And so we are, going backwards and forwards. I'll just check if there are any questions. If anyone has got any questions, you'll notice on your computer, if you're listening to the webcast, there's a little box where you can send in questions if you have any specific questions for Sally. I think you might be so engrossed you're almost forgetting to ask questions because she's covering so much in such wonderful depth. And you've given listeners here some wonderful information that it isn't often readily available to many parents directly from an expert like yourself with so much experience in this area. Would you like to just summarise the top three things parents can do to support their child's physical and social development?
Oh, gosh. It's trying to summarise it down, isn't it, into three key things?
No. So, well, even if you just want to enlarge up on, we've got time left, so if you want to enlarge up on any of the things we've talked about, maybe...
I think never be persuaded that you don't matter to your baby. My last but one book, What Babies and Children Really Need, was not the title I chose. I originally wrote it under the title First Love, Valuing Motherhood in Modern Society. Because the first love affair...
Oh, beautiful.
If the publisher didn't like it, I would have much preferred that. But it follows on from the end of The Well-Balanced Child, where I said that the first love affair of life, unquestioning love affair of life, is a baby's unconditional love for its mother. It doesn't know whether she's going to be a good mother, a bad mother, whether she loves him, whether she has postnatal depression or not. All it knows is that the mother is the one object that is his or her passport to love. And it will give its entire devotion to that mother, as long as the mother is around to respond to it. And I think in the modern world, we are often persuaded that actually, as mothers, we are not important to our children, as important to our children as we really are, and that we can afford to go and do all sorts of other things and it won't matter. And I know that, you know, it's a luxury to be able financially to be at home with your child all the time. But it's to remember that when you are at home, even if you have to go out to work, that when you are at home, your child delights in you. It isn't actually that they're just demanding of you. They actually delight in you. And to try as far as you can to enjoy that process, because it will pass very, very quickly. Within only a few years, you will go through a different age and a different stage. And that unconditional love is changes. and in the teenage years, as Pinky and I were talking about earlier, it becomes something different altogether for a while. So try to enjoy it while you can.
Yes, I was saying to Sally how one of my children had asked me could he go somewhere that was completely inappropriate a few years ago, and I said, no, you can't. And he said, why not? And I said, because I love you. And he didn't have an answer for that, so he just had to wander off and think about it. But the little babies, it is that absolute adoration that you see between mothers and babies, and fathers too are very important.
Fathers too. Fathers are terribly important, and we talk about mothers mostly, but in fact fathers are just as important as mothers. Partly because they are not mothers. Yes.
Beg your pardon, sorry?
Partly because they are not mothers, that they bring different aspects to parenting that mothers tend not to bring, if that makes sense.
Mm. They do. They have a different way of playing with babies, a different way of interacting. And I see a lot of brand new mothers who are actually very governed by their hormones, which is nature's way, that whole motherhood mindset. And yet dad can look up and be quite logical, but he's also very good at cuddling, very good at rocking. His noises are different. His smells are different. He's good at all sorts of things, and the physical play he's very good at usually, isn't he?
He is. And also his use of language with a child is usually different. That whereas, as you've sort of touched on, because of the sort of hormonal status of the mother, mothers tend to be very protective with their babies, whereas fathers tend to use more, the French have this wonderful word in their grammar, imperatif, command language. So whereas a mother might say, now, darling, will you go and do so-and-so for mummy? The father will say, go and get so-and-so for me. And it's a much more realistic use of language that the child will encounter in the outside world beyond the home, so that many of these subtle differences actually help prepare the child in different ways for play school, for school, and even for the workplace, where, you know, there isn't going to be a boss there many years later who asks you politely for something. He's going to expect you to do what he wants, whether he's been kind in his use of language or not. And these tiny things, these tiny differences do actually help to mould and shape the child to be resilient for all sorts of different things in the future.
Hmm. They do too. Fathers are different. And sometimes as a mother you might think, oh, he's being a little bit harsh, but he's actually not being harsh at all, really. He's just being that down-to-earth, realistic bloke, isn't he, quite often?
Yes.
Mm. And we're all very protective. I still don't have any questions here that people are sending in, so they must be quite fascinated with you, Sally. They haven't got questions here. None that have come up on my computer screen, it doesn't look like. I'll get another little flick and see. Look like it. But never mind, that's okay. Did you want to talk a little bit about your new book, Sally?
The Attention, Balance and Coordination one.
It's
a very different read from The Well-Balanced Child and What Babies and Children Really Need, both of which were really written for a general readership to try to encourage parents, teachers, any professionals involved with children to recognise things like why musical and physical interaction are important. And Attention, Balance and Coordination is really a book aimed at professionals and higher educational establishments trying to take into higher education to train the professionals of the future into recognizing why physical development is so important to support later learning success. Lip service is paid to this in some part of their training, but I have seen a massive difference over the last 20 years where the teachers of today, certainly in the United Kingdom, quite often have had no training, no teaching during their 3 to 4 year training on the importance of physical development to support cognitive learning. To give you an example, I regularly run a one-day course for probationary teachers who've just come to the end of their first year of teaching, showing them how to test children, school-age children, for immaturities in the control of balance and coordination, and then how to put together a daily movement program to use in schools. And I usually start the lecture day with a question as to how much time did you spend in your training on physical development? Not one hand goes up in a group of 20 people. I then ask, how much time did you spend on, did you touch on Piaget and the sensory motor stages of development? Maybe one or two hands go up each year. But what we are seeing increasingly is a new generation of professionals who are extremely well trained in a very small specific area, but no longer trained in the more general factors that link in with what they're doing in terms of teaching. Even, you know, doctors who are perhaps seeing a child with, being brought to them with a possible diagnosis of ADHD, tend to look at the behavioral factors and the pharmacological factors that can be used to treat those children, rather than looking to see if we go back in early development, are there early signs in developmental milestones and how this child has been that there may be sensory problems present, which if we address those sensory problems, we will reduce some of the signs of attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. It's not saying that it's the solution to all these difficulties, but it is often part and parcel, and it's often ignored. So the new book is an attempt to take back into those circles a thorough understanding of why these early stages of physical development can continue to affect a child's not only learning but behavior and emotional functioning for many years to come, and what can be done about it.
That's wonderful. Yes, so all the potential teachers out there, well, even parents, it can be a useful tool too, I guess. But the unwell,
well, it may help them go to sleep at night. It's not an easy thing. A good treatment for insomnia.
Right. Most parents with small children don't have a problem going to sleep other than their child. And the well-balanced child and what babies really need are really geared for parents, are they?
Yes, they're geared for everyone, but what babies and children really need is for parents of the future, new parents, grandparents. It was really me standing on my political soapbox and saying, if we want to have a society where adults understand each other and have empathy and sympathy towards each other, we need to start at the very beginning. We need to start in the teenage years, teaching youngsters at school not just sex education and how to avoid pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases, but part of that education should also be what their babies and children are going to need from them as parents when they become parents. Because we are at risk, certainly at this end of the world, of having a new generation of parents who've never had full-time parenting themselves because their parents have worked. Therefore, they don't have the complete instinct or knowledge of what a baby needs. And they then pass that on to the next generation and so on. And it's
a
very sad...
Smaller and smaller families. We have smaller and smaller families where people have not experienced a younger sibling too, which so they haven't got any sort of...
any handling
of being around children.
Exactly. Many of them have never seen a baby being breastfed. The number of young mums I see or pregnant mums I see, and I say, what are you going to breastfeed or bottle feed? And they go, ugh, breastfeeding, ugh, no, I wouldn't do that. And because they've never seen it happen, they've had no experience, they don't know either the advantages or the difficulties, but it never occurs to them to even consider it. That we have now become so divorced from our natural instincts that to them it's an unnatural thing to do. And it's a very sad reflection of our times, I think.
It is, yes, because all of these choices, people see them as choices like, shall I pick the pink one or the blue one, rather than, okay, what's the basis for these choices and what information do I need to make these choices about how I'm looking after my child?
And even before decide to have a child, if you're in a position to do that. Over here we have a wonderful charity called Foresight, which is the Organisation for Preconceptual Care. And their whole idea is that at least 6 months before a couple plan to have a baby, that they go through a process where they take themselves to optimum health in every sense for conception. And their results show that the majority of these couples go on to have wonderful, healthy babies who sleep well, are happy, contented babies, and the whole process of parenting is so much easier if you've got it right from the beginning. Obviously, we can't prevent every difficulty from occurring, but it's educating the young adults of now that what they do to their own bodies now is going to make a difference to their own children later.
And I think just that parents are motivated enough to make conscious choices makes a big difference too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I have actually got a couple of questions about children. Going back to the noise thing, seeing I haven't got any questions. And I just noticed a little child the other day, and children who are very, 2 to 3 year olds, very sensitive to noise, some of these toddlers seem to be. What can parents do for these children? Some of them just seem to have a heightened sensitivity to noise, don't they?
Yes. Now, I don't know. Sometimes it's particular types of noises, things like the vacuum cleaner, or which I think is understandable. It can be particularly prevalent in children who've had a history of a lot of ear, nose and throat infections. And this is partly because during the period of an ear infection particularly, a child will go through a period where it's partially, the hearing is impaired for a short while. When I say a short while, it can actually be for up to 8 weeks after the acute period of infection has cleared up. So if you have a child who has perhaps 2 or 3 of these a year in the first 3.5 years of life, for 24 weeks of that year, their hearing actually may be partly impaired as a result of blockage and so on. When the blockage clears, then the little protective reflex that should come into play so that when there are loud noises, it shuts it down by as much as 20 decibels, that little reflex in theory might have become lazy. And they can't then tolerate loud noises in the way that other children can do. It's very much like a deaf person putting a hearing aid in and then saying, oh, I can't cope with all the background noise. As a result of having clear hearing after a period of dampened hearing, they then become super sensitive and unable to tolerate certain things. It's obviously not the explanation for all children, but in many cases where there's been a history of a lot of ear, nose and throat infections, you find that hypersensitivity is an ongoing issue.
Okay, and in otherwise healthy children, I know my youngest one used to get very upset about, he'd hear noises in the background, perhaps a computer in another room, nobody was even typing, but the fact that it had been left switched on, he'd be upset about that noise. He was so acute, his hearing was. He was later diagnosed with some auditory processing difficulties. Some of the children I've seen lately just get upset about parents having a conversation, and these are often quite loud, vibrant parents.
I think that's kind of two sets of issues. I think you're talking possibly about two different causes or different issues.
Two different things, yeah.
The computer, it's quite possible your son was hypersensitive to certain sound frequencies only, and therefore picked up the sound of the computer when no one else was aware of it. And we do see a lot of children who have, as you said, later on identified as having auditory processing difficulties, who are hypersensitive to certain frequencies and then less sensitive to others that they actually need. And there are various systems of sound therapy, not with very young children, but with slightly older children, that can be used to either sensitize or desensitize a child to certain sound frequencies, provided there isn't a hearing problem. Before birth, a lot of it is actually in Russian, but I believe he's having it translated into English. There is a wonderful Russian pediatrician by the name of Michael Lazarev, who is both a pediatrician and a PhD in music. And he has developed a whole program of music stimulation from the third trimester of pregnancy right up to 7 years of age, designed to stimulate and educate a child's hearing and motor coordination at each developmental stage. So he uses music, he uses song, he uses rhythm. And I don't know what he's done with his rhythms, but somewhere he seems to have got it absolutely right. And I don't know, how much time have we got left? Have I got time to tell you a story?
Yes, you can. We're up to an hour, but we can go over. That's
all right. Quite quickly, a number of years ago, my husband and I were lecturing in Poland. And after we had finished lecturing, we were asked to see a series of families of children with autistic spectrum disorder. And all of the consultation had to be done through a translator. And I got to about the fourth child that I was seeing, who was a little six-year-old boy with quite severe autistic-type problems. And at that point, the translator went off to have her lunch. And I was left with this child who had language problems of his own, and certainly we had no English or Polish that we could communicate in with each other. And I didn't know quite what to do with him. So while I was waiting for her to come back, I simply switched on the little recording of Lazaroff's songs for 3 to 6 year olds. And each one is a character like a sea anemone or a crocodile or a lizard or a bear, each one parallel to a different stage of motor development. So the bear is obviously like the child crawling on hands and knees. The caterpillar is like the child lying on its belly trying to pull itself along the ground. The crocodile is a little bit more advanced and so on. And I put the crocodile music on, which has very, very distinctive rhythms. And this little boy, without understanding the language, without being told to do it, got down on the floor and started to crawl like a crocodile. So something in the rhythms that Lazaroff uses in his music actually suggests the type of movement that the child should be making at a different stage of development. And I think his program is just one. I mean, I know there are many others around, but just one which seems to have got it absolutely right for helping children through movement and through music to develop both the listening, the speaking, and the coordination skills that they need to then build the next layer up when they reach the next stage. I think I've gone terribly off the point in answering that.
I know, I was thinking, oh, we're having a lovely chat here, but it really is a bit like a little lounge room chat, isn't it, really? That's fascinating, though, that we're actually having Hilary Henshaw speaking. It's going to be our next interview, and she's a music and language specialist here in Australia. So
right.
She's just written a program with a speech therapist here, so a lecturer in speech what do you call them? The professional
therapist. Yes.
So she will follow on really nicely from this, but it is fascinating that the whole language, the movement, children do start off learning through the movement, and, you know, that we do need all these layers of brain development and impulse control. Again, I guess that's the not sitting still or the doing silly things or you know, silly behaviour. It's all down to the brain layers.
To do with the brain and also to do with, on one end, having the opportunity to work through it, and on the other end, having safe boundaries put around you as a child so that you learn when far is far enough, when it's time to stop, when someone is actually getting cross with you. And a child doesn't learn self-discipline without some good discipline being ring-fenced around them. And that's not the same as chastisement. Discipline in its true sense means one whom is a pupil, one who is taught. And one is taught by having appointed boundaries through which you bounce, against which you bounce, and you come back and you try it again and you bounce back and you learn to live within those and only to test them when it's appropriate to do it. So it's both opportunity and security, I think, that we need.
That's actually lovely, opportunity and security for little people. It's a good way to describe it, isn't it? The opportunity and the security. Sally, you've given listeners here some wonderful information here today. I just am finding it fascinating just listening to you, and I'm sure our listeners are too. So thank you for taking the time to share this really important information today. Now, if listeners want to find out more about you and your work or buy your books, where can they go? We'll just mention those titles once again, shall we? We'll just mention them again so that, you know, and are all your books available at the moment?
Okay. The one that I think is probably of most interest to your readers at the age and stage their children are at the moment is the What Babies and Children Really Need, which I'm pretty sure is available on Amazon. There's a Steiner supplier, I think, in the UK, in Australia. Similarly, The Well-Balanced Child, which looks at all the issues of what are the similarities between music and language, why is balance important for emotional development, and so on. The one that we mentioned earlier that's really more designed for professionals, Attention, Balance, and Coordination, looking at the mechanisms involved, the physical mechanisms involved in supporting later learning. And my very first book, Reflexes, Learning, and Behavior, which describes the reflexes in some detail. And if you want to find out more about either these books, other publications, training courses, how you can have your child assessed, or anyone who is doing our work in Australia, you can go on to the INPP website, which is www.inpp.org.uk, or my own website, which is www.sallygoddardblythe.co.uk.
And that's Blythe with an E, everybody.
It is.
We've actually got a link to that on our teleseminar site. So if people are listening in or you're listening to the recording, you can click on that link and get through to Sally's website and also the www.anpp.org.uk. So thank you so much, Sally, for this great information. And I hope it's really helpful for you to parents out there. And, you know, for some early movement experiences in Australia, as Sally has mentioned, or New Zealand, you could try Jimbaroo. So that's jimbaroo.com.au. And see if there's a centre near you, just to give you a little bit of help with some ideas for early movement. But, yes, check out Sally's books. Follow up that information. And this is Pinky signing off. Everyone have a great day, and I'll see you next week with another wonderful speaker in our series. In the meantime, love, laugh and enjoy, and please be as gentle to yourself and your beloved as you are to your little ones. Thank you very much.